This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Walk Wai Wai, the international LGBT news and current affairs show. Every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community. This is the World Wide Wave.
So this is World Wide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show, taking you around the globe one country at a time. Tonight we have Paul.
Good evening.
And myself, Dean. And we're continuing our look back at the highs and lows of LGBTI rights in 2016. We're off to Italy, the United States, Cook Islands, South Africa. We're going all over the place tonight. Here's a taste of what we have coming up tonight.
The Asia-Pacific epidemic, the Asia epidemic in particular, is enormous. And I think, you know, we all know of the incredible, you know, extraordinary and horrifying epidemic in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. But I think that's kind of obscured just the scale of need and the scale of urgency that we see in the Asia region.
We're starting off in Italy. The Italian Film Festival this year had a very strong selection of queer content, including the story of the highly controversial and openly gay journalist, filmmaker and artist who was murdered in 1975. That's Pier Paolo Pasolini, who directed Theorem and Canterbury Tales and a whole bunch of other very challenging and very innovative movies back in the day. The man who brought his controversial story to the screen is David Greco, director of the film La Macchina Zioni, The Ploy.
Joy.
The film is about Pier Paolo Pasolini, who is fairly foreign to us as Australians, but seems like quite an extraordinary person. Tell us a bit about him.
He was really, and you said the word. He was an extraordinary man, and I think he showed that most of all as a journalist. No one agrees to call him a journalist, I don't know why, in Italy, but he's been really an amazing journalist. He's been writing things that I don't know, no other journalist in the world had the courage to write what he wrote. I mean, not even Woodward and Bernstein at the times of Nixon impeachment. He was so straight because he was also a poet, so he was saying the things just like the things are, not even trying to mask names and facts, and he really did an incredible job. But this is why he's been killed. He really went too far.
Give us a bit of an idea of how big he was, how big his profile was in Italy.
The profile was big, but it was also a very scandalous profile. I mean, the Italian were exactly divided in people pro and people against Pasolini. And in a very, very straight way, just as an example, it happened to me two times walking on the street with him and crossing some people, spitting on him.
Wow.
And once, I was very young at the time, and once I jumped on this guy in order to react, and he stopped me, saying, you know, I'm very used to it. Don't worry. No problem. Just go on. Just ignore him. We don't want to make a fight in the middle of the street. Just to tell you how much he was loved by some and how much he was hated by some others. Even to talk about numbers, he was writing on Il Corriere della Sera, which was, at the time, no doubt, the main newspaper in Italy. And every time he was writing an article, the readers were estimated around 5 to 6 million. Of course, 40 years ago, people were a lot more used to read newspapers. Now we have internet, and now it's different. But he was really important at the time. And everyone was shocked by what he was writing, but he didn't stop for that.
How did people react to him being gay? I mean, what was being gay like in Italy in the 60s and 70s? He was living openly as a homosexual?
Absolutely. Not only openly, but he was very provocative about it. If you go to see a beautiful documentary made that is called Comizi d'Amore, and it's a reportage through Italy where he travels himself with a microphone and interviews people, women, men, children, about sexuality. And he always says, what do you think about homosexuals? And not even using that word homosexual, but using the words that, of course, not beautiful words that the people used to say. And he was saying that was his face. And he was very popular at the time, very successful. That was, of course, after Accattone and Mamma Roma, his first two films. And he loved to do that. And some people were embarrassed, but at the same time, he took out from these people he interviewed the truth. Because he was so saying the truth that he was kind of asking the truth to everybody. And if you see that documentary, it's quite amazing from an anthropologic and sociologic point of view. It's very important to describe the Italy of that time, of the city. He was all the time in the streets, not only at night, because there's such a mythology about his sexual appetite. There's been so many people saying he was sadomasochistic, which was not true at all. He was always on the street. And as soon as he started earning money, all his money were in his pocket. And in Rome, everyone was approaching him like, sorry, Paolo, my mother is sick. We need a doctor. We don't have the money. Or I've lost my job. I've lost my house. And he was giving money to everybody. And saying, I don't care if someone is lying and it's just a trick to have some money. I have some money and I have to share this money with everybody.
David Grieco, director of the film La Macchina Zioni, telling the story of the outrageous and controversial Italian director P. Paolo Pasolini. You're listening to Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Hello and goedenavond. This is Elko, listening in from the Netherlands on Worldwide Wave, the latest LGBT news and current affairs on joy.org.au.
We have a message from our old friend 317. Hello, hardworking people. Your insights and analysis on global issues were again superb this year. I'm listening by the beach with glass in hand and raising a toast to all your team. Thank you for a tremendous year of news and interesting stories that always inspire and educate me constantly. Stop, stop. Tell me more about my eyes.
We flatterer. Love you, flatterer, you.
It will get you everywhere, won't it, Paul?
Now, our next clip. In our genuine and good-hearted attempts to be inclusive, sometimes grouping the LGBTI community as one creates problems. Some groups are more visible and have greater representation than others. In some countries, women are already starting from a lower point in the terms of rights before adding sexuality into the mix. The UK's Human Dignity Trust is a group of international lawyers providing free legal advice to people in countries where homosexuality and bisexuality is illegal. During this year, they produced a report, Breaking the Silence, Criminalisation of Lesbian and Bisexual Women and Its Impacts. While we'll often bring you stories of advances in LGBT rights, one of the findings of the Human Dignity Trust report was there are about 10 countries which have recently added new criminal sanctions against lesbians.
Boo! Boo!
We spoke to Tara Braun, the legal director of the Human Dignity Trust, and asked her to explain what was driving these changes.
Well, I think the starting point is that many of these laws originated from Britain during the colonial period. The laws originate either from British colonialism, as opposed to the other European colonizing countries, or from Sharia law. Those are the two main sources. And if we look at the British origins, Britain only criminalized men. It never criminalized women. There was an attempt in 1921, I think it was, to add women, but that never passed through Parliament. So the origins of the laws were focused on male relationships. but the way they ended up being spread around at different points in history, it didn't necessarily retain that focus. They were worded differently at different points. But in terms of the more recent developments in the last 30 years or so, at least 10 countries have specifically amended those British colonial laws to include women. It seems to be, in some instances, it was simply out of a attempt to equalize the laws, to make sure that there was not an argument that the laws were discriminatory and that they only applied to men and didn't apply to women. So it was an attempt to sort of further protect the laws from challenge on arguments that they were somehow discriminatory. And of course, the laws are discriminatory regardless of how they're framed. So that was part of it. But also, in many countries, there seems to be a growing awareness of homosexuality generally. And in those countries where there are still very strong homophobic cultural and societal views, there is a greater attempt to make sure that all people are being captured and that the laws and the enforcement of the laws is capturing not just men, but women as well. And in some countries, indeed, women have become greater targets. They're more visible, perhaps, than they were in earlier decades and centuries. Their rights and you know, the discussion about homosexuality or sexual orientation and gender identity generally is much more prevalent now. So in those countries where they're determined to maintain these laws, there are efforts to make sure that everybody is captured by them.
Let's talk about some of the social impacts of women who have sex with women. What are the kinds of discrimination or, I guess, social stigma did you uncover for this group?
That indeed was one of the purposes, was to look at, because I think what we realized and what we wanted to make sure was discussed more was that while there are certain social impacts that affect the entire LGBT community, and that's the way in which those social impacts are often discussed. We often just group LGBT people together, and rightly so in many ways, because the impacts are the same regardless of who you are within that broader community. In addition to the generalized ways in which the entire LGBT community is impacted by these types of laws, there are certain unique ways that different members of the community are affected. So for lesbian and bisexual women, there's often, for instance, what we call intersectionality between their sex and their sexual orientation. And that can create a certain type of vulnerability to human rights abuse and social impacts. So simply by being a woman in many countries, there are different types of human rights violations and social pressures and marginalization that occur. If you add to that being a lesbian or bisexual woman, you have this double form of discrimination. So women in many countries are, for instance, economically dependent on men. They don't have the same economic rights. They don't have the same political rights and roles. And by being economically dependent on men as a lesbian and bisexual woman, you are much more likely to be pressured into a heterosexual marriage. You're also much more likely to carry a particular burden of forming a traditional family, having children within that traditional family. You may be much less likely to have control over your sexuality and your sexual and reproductive choices in life. There are also certain types of violence that are not unique to you, but certainly disproportionately faced by women, such as so-called corrective rape, where perpetrators attempt to cure the homosexuality of a woman through rape. And often that is initiated through family members. It's not necessarily strangers or community members. A lot of the types of violence or pressures or control for women also happen within the private sphere, and that's true of all women, whereas the human rights violations of men may more be visible in the public sphere.
Bisexuals in general, and I guess more particularly bisexual women, tend to struggle to gain recognition and profile. Why was it important for you that bisexual women were included in this project?
Yes, for that very reason. I mean, even to the extent that we can pull out information globally about lesbian and bisexual women, there is significantly less that is specifically addressed at bisexual women. So there's some data from certain Western countries, for instance, in the report on domestic violence experiences of bisexual women, which is much higher and even lesbian women and straight women, but there is virtually no data that's specific to bisexual women and the issues that they face. So this report attempts to look at the ways in which women who have sex with women, however they may self-identify, the issues that they face. But I think what it highlights as well is that even more, what we need to be doing is disaggregating our research and data. So rather than just looking at LGBTIQ, however you define it, as a sort of homogeneous community, as global researchers, as lawyers, as social justice advocates, we need to be looking at the particular issues faced by the different constituent members. Because without that data and without that information, we won't be addressing those particular issues. We'll sort of just be looking at it as a homogeneous group, and inevitably that means that the more visible people and the more visible issues are the ones that get addressed and the other ones are rendered invisible. So that's why our report is titled Breaking the Silence. So we're trying to at least raise that one of the key things that needs to be done is more research, and in particular disaggregated research.
Taya Braun, Legal Director at Human Dignity Trust, highlighting the additional challenges of acceptance for women who have sex with women.
We've had another message. All the way from Sydney, Sarah. The news never stops. Thanks for bringing us different stories each week. Keep them coming. Well, that's our intention. This is World Wide Wave on Joy.
I am Bisi Alimi from Nigeria. For those who say homosexuality is a Western import to Africa, I am a proof that you can be proudly African and gay and fabulous. And I'm on World Wide Wave.
HIV was in the spotlight this year with AIDS 2016, which was the 21st International AIDS Conference held in July in Durban, South Africa. Following one of the largest health conferences in the world, we took the opportunity to explore the conference from an Australian viewpoint. Daryl O'Donnell is the head of Australia's peak AIDS organisation, AFAO, the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations. And we started by asking Daryl what his overall experience as a participant of the 21st International AIDS Conference was like.
Oh, look, it's an extraordinary conference. It's, you know, it's a week with 2 days of pre-meetings, 17,000 people, you know, 158 sessions. It's just the scale of this thing is kind of hard to imagine until you're actually right in the middle of it. And it's probably unique as a conference because it brings together everyone from your, you know, your laboratory benchtop scientists through to activists and your politicians and your media and your celebrities and community organisations. Like it's quite extraordinary in terms of bringing together all of those people who, for all of their differences, are actually kind of working together to try and you know, battle this epidemic.
As the peak body for HIV and AIDS in Australia, what were your key outtakes for the conference for Australia?
For me, a big focus of my time at the conference was on actually the question of HIV financing, less so for Australia, but for the region. So really, you know, the question of, you know, how can countries actually sustain the level of investment they need to? How can we as community, as advocates, how can we actually demand of our governments and of governments in the region that they actually invest in the kinds of responses we need in order to provide us with treatment, in order to allow us to mobilise, in order to provide education? So a lot of my focus was around this question of making sure that governments here in Australia, but actually also throughout the Asia-Pacific region, that governments are actually investing so that our communities can actually, you know, work together to, you know, work towards progress in battling the epidemic.
Talking about the region, because you have quite a few programs that you work on throughout the region, where does the Asia-Pacific region sit in regards, you know, in relation to the rest of the world in terms of HIV and AIDS?
Look, the Asia-Pacific epidemic, the Asia epidemic in particular, is enormous. And I think, you know, we all know of the incredible, you know, extraordinary and horrifying epidemic in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. But I think that's kind of obscured just the scale of need and the scale of urgency that we see in the Asia region. You know, just in the last year, in the last 12 months, well, you know, we saw 180,000 people die from AIDS in the Asia region. And every one of those people that died for want of access to treatment that we know can actually keep them well and keep them alive. And so there's just unimaginable need in the region, both for access to life-saving treatment, but also for basic prevention, for the basic kinds of supports that we've enjoyed in Australia that allow us as, you know, gay communities, as communities of people who inject drugs or as sex workers, as Aboriginal people, whatever it is, but that have allowed us in Australia to get together, to work together, to educate each other and to stay safe.
Daryl O'Donnell, CEO of AFAO, Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations, speaking there on the understated size of the HIV epidemic in Asia to us here at Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9. We've had another message from Sarah. Us Sydneysiders wish all the Melburnians a happy new year, even though our fireworks are better. What cheek. I think that the gauntlet, the gauntlet has been thrown down just because we don't have an ostentatious bridge to like drape our fireworks all over.
We actually spread them around the city so everyone gets to enjoy them.
Yeah, every second building has like fireworks, so you know, much more egalitarian than snobby Sydney. Thank you, Sarah. Anyway, it's nice to know you are listening.
Back to the our clips, and now we're off to the USA. The narrative 30 years ago regarding HIV and AIDS was all about survival. Dealing with old age was not a problem that anyone considered. Medicines have come such a long way in that time, but new research is looking at the effects of HIV on aging. Could it be that a miracle drug that keeps HIV-positive people alive is also aging them at a faster rate? We asked Dr. Alan Landay whether he knew yet if the HIV virus or the antiretroviral drugs being used to fight HIV were causing these aging effects.
It's multifactorial, and that's a great question because we know we can suppress the virus by our current techniques, but those techniques really measure the virus in the blood. And so we're down to studying at a clinical level less than 20 copies of HIV in the blood, which means you're what we now say clinically virologically suppressed. Well, 20 copies isn't zero, so we do know that if we use more sensitive research assays, single copy assays, we may find virus in the blood. But more importantly, there may be viral reservoirs in tissue. So we're now beginning to ask questions about the effects of our current drug regimens. Do they get into the tissues effectively? How well do they suppress the virus? And how well do they reconstitute the immune system? In terms of the drugs, that's also a critical question because we know in the past the various drugs known as the D drugs, DDI, D4T, DDC, had metabolic toxicities. We also know a number of the protease inhibitors caused lipid abnormalities. What we now find today, people starting in 2016, the regimens are much more friendly in terms of the toxicity profile. They're less toxic. But we still have a large number of patients who were starting treatment in the early days, in the late 80s, early 90s, and they're still alive today because of the tremendous advances in our abilities to treat patients, especially with the first heart regimens that came out in 1995. So many of those patients are, you know, still here today in 2016 who were starting then. You know, they were 30 then, and they're 50 today. So they're now aging, and so the sort of long-term effects of some of the exposures to drugs, as well as the aspects of chronologic aging, are contributing to some of these factors.
So we could see people in their, you know, 40s or 50s with cardiovascular disease or dementia or things like that as a result of a long-term...
Well, that's still an open-ended question. We do know that there's an acceleration of immune senescence early on and that the immune system is affected. Now, how that manifests clinically is still under investigation and hasn't, as we call, the jury is still out. So we ask a question, and we've written many reviews, is HIV accelerating aging? Is it accentuating aging? And the other question is, are there other lifestyle factors in our population that may be contributing to cardiovascular disease? So do the patients that we're studying, do they smoke more, or do they have more alcohol consumption? Some of those factors are normal risk factors for cardiovascular disease, for instance.
What are the implications for our health systems? And I guess, is it different for a rich country like Australia compared to a third world country that may not have the health system that we have here?
I think that's actually very important because these are going to be, we want to be able to prevent these comorbidities because they are going to have a significant effect in the healthcare systems in a country like Australia, and these patients are going to, you know, they're living longer, so they're going to need more health care, perhaps more interventional strategies. So what we're trying to figure out is what can we do to intervene and prevent so that patients who come in today to be started on therapy, if they have a higher risk for any of these comorbid conditions, can we give them prevention up front, like a statin or an aspirin, something as a simple regimen? In the developing world, let's say Africa is one example, we're also seeing more of the non-communicable diseases in general. And when we sit down and when we had at the Durban AIDS meeting this year in Africa, there was a lot of interest in non-communicable diseases from the perspective of the World Health Organization, because what we're seeing now is on a global basis, we're dealing more with these non-communicable diseases than we are infectious diseases in Africa, a lot more diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So how in that healthcare system, which is much less resourced than in Australia, how we're going to be able to implement that, that's going to be much more difficult. What we're trying to do is use resources we've already built for HIV studies and HIV care in these populations and open up clinics where the patients who are being seen for HIV now are going to be looked at for their cardiovascular disease, looked at for their diabetes. And those clinics and infrastructure resources can clearly be expanded to help in the non-HIV populations as well. So this is a great example where building infrastructure, which Australia and many other countries have done across the world, not just in Africa, but in the Asia-Pacific and other places now, especially places like New Guinea, which is very much involved with Australia research and evaluation, that we can begin to implement these kinds of infrastructure changes.
That was Dr. Alan Landay from the Rush University Medical Center in Chicago.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
I'm Stefan from Taiwan. You're listening to Worldwide Wave.
We had a show this year about the Cook Islands, and following the LGBTI Pacific Youth Forum in Sydney, which was hosted by our friends Kaleidoscope Australia, we profiled the LGBTI rights and life in some of our Pacific neighbours. Homosexuality is illegal in the Cook Islands. So we spoke to Tatriana Eden Lacroix, and she gave us an insight into life for LGBT people in the Cook Islands and her work with the Taitiere Association.
Tell us a bit about Taitiere Association and what you do for the LGBT community in Cook Islands.
Taitiere launched itself in 2008, so it's been going for like 8 years now. And since its launch, it's been promoting mainly health awareness, like safe sex and awareness around HIV and AIDS for the LGBT communities. But recently, it took a step into trying to change some laws, particularly the decriminalization of homosexuality in the Cook Islands. As part of its campaign, it also ran a pageant, which is the first of its kind in like 10 years, to help promote and, you know, start normalizing the conversation between amongst the communities about LGBT issues and about how we were going to go about to decriminalize this law that's currently hovering against our community, I guess.
I'll come back to the law. Just paint us a bit of a picture of what life is like for an LGBT person in Cook Islands.
It's kind of cruisy. Like, you know, it's not as, I guess, in a sense, it's not as shunned as some other people may describe in their own communities. Like, it's generally acceptable to be an LGBT person. Like myself, growing up, it's been safe, and I'm pretty comfortable, and I know that my friends are pretty comfortable. However, when issues of, like, maybe same-sex marriage and stuff start arising, that's when people start to have a little problem about being LGBT. In the Cook Islands, like, in the homes, it's generally accepted, and nobody really has a problem with it unless there is some awareness around it.
Does that mean you need to be discreet in your life?
Yes, I think so. So I think in your sexual life, you definitely have to be discreet, and that's a definitely an aspect of our lives that we do not show out. So we do not show public affection for one another because it's not generally acceptable. But we're accepted out in the communities when we're like helping out and creating events and stuff like that and designing costumes and all that stuff. But to be LGBTI in partnership with someone else and showing affection publicly, that's not generally acceptable, and you kind of have to keep it discreet.
Tell us a bit about family and I guess the role that family plays in Cook Islands culture and how that might impact LGBT people, you know, with, say, things like coming out.
Well, family is really important if you're LGBT growing up in Cook Islands, because it's such a small community that if you don't have your family, you really don't have the support system, because if you step away from your family, your family is bound to know the person that you're going to step away from, and it could influence other people's views on you. So a lot of the time, we're trying to please our families and keep them happy. And it is your family who will kind of like give you that strong support system if you decide to come out, because being such a small community, you're easily targeted, I guess, if you don't have your family around. For me, it was really important that I had my family with me, coming out, my mom, my sisters, because then if my family accepted me and outside communities saw that, then they probably wouldn't have a problem with it. But if my family didn't accept me and then I went out and, you know, became who I wanted to be, the community would look at me and be like, oh, well, she's not really a good person because she left her family and is disobedient, rebellious, and all of that other stuff.
It's sort of like social exclusion in the community.
Yes.
Tatriana from the TTR Association in the Cook Islands, and she spoke to World Wide Wave a few months back, and easily the most glamorous person we've ever interviewed. Fantastic.
Now, we know which one is my favourite show. You've already given that away. Which one was your favourite show?
Look, this is such a lame answer, but there are actually quite a few. Like, I think that we had a pretty solid year. I really liked the Dennis Altman show that we did not that long ago. I thought he was a great guest, really interesting. One of those shows where I just wish we had 2 hours and we could just give Beyond the Binary as kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card and take over for an hour.
Give because them the night off.
That's it, yeah, because he was fascinating. He was very interesting. But, you know, there's been a lot of good shows this year.
Yeah. I would agree with you. We do try to produce some quality radio.
That's true. And we've had a message in from our friend 317 in response to my request for feedback, have the intro as the Prince song Around the World in a Day as an introduction to replace Daft Punk. You know, that's not a bad idea. We'll have to run it past our Führer, Matt, and see what he says about that.
You mean our team?
Yes. Wonderful producer, Matt, who's listening from wherever he is and will no doubt punish me when he gets back. We love you, Matt.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
Hi, I'm Mamikon Hovsepian. I work for Pink Armenia, and our organization deals with LGBT issues here for the World Wide Wave.
And thank you to all our guests across the year who've given their time and also a piece of themselves by telling their story. You can revisit these shows on podcast covering LGBT life in about 140 countries at our website, which is joy.org.au/worldwidewave. And thank you to everyone for all your messages and all those who've joined or interacted with us on Facebook this past week and, in fact, this past year.
And, of course, we would love to say thank you to Mark, our podcaster, for all the hard work he's done, and Damien.
And the lovely Gordon. Always at the front desk. He's like a tireless little pit pony. He's amazing. And, of course, we've got another year of World Wide Wave coming up.
And to go out with, we've got some George Michael.
That's it. Too Funky from Red Hot and Dance.
Thanks for listening to another podcast of World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne or online across the world at joy.org.au. You'll find all of our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave. Or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now. Just to forget.
Australia's most amazing gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.